This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 34 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. This episode will feature a guest, an interview with Tevis Thompson, who you may have read his, he writes a lot about games, he does reviews for games. I know him from an old piece that he wrote probably almost, 8 years ago now, called Saving Zelda, which I recommend you check out. That was something that very much just attracted me to his kind of, his perspective, which just seems very different from other people's. And in some ways, it's an interesting conversation because I think in some ways we have very, very different philosophies. But in some ways, I think actually there's very, very similar things going on. So, and I think that there might be, if we had two or three more conversations like this, I think we might have some serious agreement. I also think that probably our agreement would increase if I were to play the games that he plays, things like Last Guardian, which I have not played, but from his conversation sounds like something, I mean, interactively, I'm extremely skeptical of it, of course, but thematically and in some sort of like art, interactive art installation kind of way, I think sounds very interesting. And so I think if he were to play like board games, and if I were to play that, I think we actually might be able to find some real connection. But even as it is, I think we had a lot to talk about. And so without further ado, I give you the conversation with Tevis Thompson. We talked about a lot of topics. And talking about, you know, themes in games, violence and game criticism and the lack of games criticism and all kinds of stuff. So I think you'll enjoy it. So without further ado, second time, here it is.
So I heard you on the 1099 podcast, and I really liked that a lot. I've also, you know, I've read your stuff in the past. I remember Saving Zelda was, to me, I was like, I feel very alone in the video game industry in that I feel the way you feel and the way that you were on the 1099 podcast. Like, I feel like I was like you, but even more so. Like, I feel even more alienated and more disconnected from the culture of video games and, you know, what's expected of us as gamers, you know, what we're supposed to be excited about and all that kind of stuff. So and so hearing you is very, very like refreshing and sort of comforting to me that there's people like you out there, because I feel like there's just not a lot of voices like that. You know,
I think there's more of us out there than we think, because every time I speak up, people come and say me too, or like, I feel like very alone. I think that it's sometimes invisible. But yeah, I do think there's a lot of people feeling this way.
Yeah. I just want to mention a couple of, kind of, voices that I'm aware of there's almost like a self-reinforcing mechanism in the culture that makes it harder for those things to exist and to sort of perpetuate themselves. For example, I'm a fan of Feminist Frequency. I know a lot of people have mixed feelings about them, but for example, they have this thing where they start all their videos by saying, you know, it's okay to like love these, like it's okay to criticize the things that you love. I think that's kind of like a slogan that they have. Just because you're criticizing this doesn't mean that you don't love it and you don't think it's great and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of feel like, yeah, but isn't it also okay to kind of say, I don't love this thing because of this criticism? I reject this thing. Like, and that's such an unsafe, volatile thing, it seems like. Like, why, maybe you could speak to that. Like, why is that something that we can't say?
Yeah, that's I understand the feeling. I also like Feminist Frequency, and I feel I can see where that kind of slogan or that preface they always give kind of comes from, given the way that they kind of develop their platform and their criticism.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, I'm not blaming them, because I don't think they...
I know you're not. And I it's not really about that, because I like them quite a bit. And I think that... Well, so they're in a space where the gaming space that is, you know, just... has this almost, you know, terminal disease of like positivity, right? Just this, like, this overwhelming need to boost, to advocate for, to defend. And part of that's based, I think, in that we have these deep loves, and they are, many of us through our entire lives, with games, or new, but they games tend to hit hard. They get inside us. And like you, when I hear that kind of statement, I think to myself, okay, can we also examine the source of our love, for instance? You know, can we not just, you know, criticize and love as if like those don't happily coexist all the time.
Sure.
You know, that's to treat it like it's all going to be good because, you know, we're just going to love and criticize together. Real criticism, I think, of the kind that I want to do and do, and that you seem interested in as well, that they're not always pleasant. They don't always lead us back to our love. I want to take the love seriously, but also question it. I mean, I think you see a lot of times a kind of a statement of, you know, sometimes I don't think this thing is good, but I love it. Which right. is always a very strange statement to me.
Sure.
Because I think what we love, what we like, is the clearest window into what we think is good. And I think that dividing that out or trying to make these separations, it just, what's that serving? It seems like it's trying to make us feel okay, like we're going to, you know, partition the criticism off in this little corner and then go back to business as usual, or business as usual with slight tweaks. You know, the criticism can't go very deep into us as players. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in my criticism, I always come back to the player. The heart of my criticism is in being a player. And I just don't think you can talk about games without talking about the player. And that might get real messy. Like, that might get real, like, questioning people's values, questioning why they like what they like. And maybe there's something wrong with some of the things we like. I'm open to that question. So, yeah, I hear you that there's something that it sounds like a good starting place, but I feel like a lot of people in there and they want to just, you know, get their little dose of medicine and then go back to the fun. And I don't want to do that. And I want to push all the aspects of that our loving and what we criticize and see, push it as far as it'll go and see what happens.
Right. Yeah. I agree with all that. The only thing I would maybe like half push back on is the idea of there being a sort of disconnect between saying, you know, when people will say, I think it's a words thing. When people say, I love this thing, but I think it's bad. I think that they're trying to say that there's numerous axes that, you know, that I can judge this thing on. And like the net of it is, I want this thing in my life, but there are these problems that really are real problems that I'm not letting it off the hook for. Like, that's kind of what I hear when I hear that.
I suppose. I guess I would. I feel like all those other axes or all those other things, that there's something about liking our base, like if you say I like something or not, there is something really piercing, and it kind of, you know, short circuits a lot of our thinking about things. It's also often an initial response, a visceral response. And I just want to take it seriously, that liking, and not downplay it. So you might have somebody say like, well, my favorite games of the year are often 7s out of 10s. And okay, you know, they're mm-hmm. trying to say I like things that are not the 10 out of 10's fine, and that I like these weird things that don't quite totally work. And I get that sentiment. And yet my response is usually, why don't you, I think if it's your favorite game of the year, I think that you think it's a 10 out of 10. Like, if you're going to say, you know, using those mm-hmm. numbers and stuff.
Sure, sure.
If you were going to say it's your favorite, why are you hedging on that? Why are, like, that other criteria that you're acknowledging, you're giving it a credence and saying that, like, giving it some authority, when instead the authority should be yours. You should tell everyone that you want, like, why it's your favorite? And I, you know, this is, maybe it's another conversation, this favorite and best, but yeah, I'm not very, I don't like distinguishing it that much, because I think that it shows an unwillingness to really go into what you like again, to defend it even. But like, you're not going to hear me say The Last Guardian is the best game of last year. And here's all these little things, you know, because I'm stating that the things people are complaining about in The Last Guardian are not important. And in fact, they're playing it wrong. So I'm willing to make that statement and say that it's not a compromised best for me. And that when I say The Witcher was the best game last year, I fully acknowledge all of it. It has, you know, frankly, some of the worst and most, it has, you know, some horrible scenes with women in it. It has a lot of bullshit in it. But I have no problem in saying it's the best game of last year and defending it and saying why.
Is that just because all the other games were worse? Because, like, that's how I hear that sentence.
No. It does things that no game has ever done.
Okay.
And it does them really well. And this is the thing where I mean that, like, our liking is the clearest, you know, window into what we think is good. It's the clearest window into what we value. Mm-hmm. What The Witcher does well, I value, and I don't see anywhere else. What The Last Guardian does well, no other game does, and I deeply value it. And what people claim it doesn't do well, I think is petty and small by my values.
Okay.
So that's why I want to go that far and not, you know, just kind of, you know, again, I feel like I'm giving over to some sort of criteria that isn't my own.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to figure out my criteria, because that's what's important to everyone.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So that leads really well into my next question, which is a very broad question. But my question is sort of like, what appeals to you about interactive entertainment just at all? Like, so like, say no one's ever heard, like, you met someone and they've just never heard of video games, and you had to explain to them why it competes for your time against other activities like movies or studying or reading or just browsing the internet. Like, how would you explain to someone what the value is of interactive entertainment from your point of view? And that, you can use things like The Witcher or Last Guardian,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's obviously a very hard question. And it's hard for someone like me who has played games their entire life, you know, since the Atari 2600. And so there's not, it's not like I came into it and, you know, it's kind of been there. I think that when you're looking at what's interesting about, I sense that you're going to have a different answer than me about this.
This is, for me, it's a little bit of a leading question. People who know my work, but anyway,
you know, in reading some of your stuff and watching it, I sense that what you value and what you care about in games is different than me. So, please, you know, I'm sure you'll tell me that after, but, I think that every person who plays games, I don't pretend that we all like them for the same reasons, or that broad category of games, it is very broad. And I prefer the broadest definitions. If you look at my best games, like, you know, some of them would be questionably interactive by some people's standards. Mm-hmm. And there's my tastes come through, my values come through. I think when it comes to that interactivity, because while I'm not interested in arguments very much if that's not a game or something. The games that really do something that can't be done elsewhere, those have an appeal to me, and I don't deny. You can't do Minecraft elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do the things and, you know, that I think that The Witcher does well elsewhere, even though there are books. I actually read The Last Wish last year.
Is that in the same series or something?
Yeah, it's it's a collection of short stories in the Witcher universe, and with some overlap of things that happen.
Well, okay, to me, the Minecraft example is quite obvious. I feel like that is very obviously, compellingly something that can only be a video game, and I totally agree with that. But the Witcher one is a lot less obvious, so maybe you could talk about why, you know, how does the Witcher express something that, you know, why is it being an interactive thing?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I should say that, you know, my background is primarily literature. So books, linear narratives, are something I I come from, they're even more of the background of my life than games, or just, you know, certainly as much, if not more, and some other media. But having read The Witcher, The Last Wish, this collection of short stories about Geralt and the whole universe, it was an interesting experience because it was good. You know, I read it and I was like, you know, I read tons of fantasy as a child, less as an adult, because I find that I don't find very many good fantasy novels. But it was good. If I had never played the game, I would have thought, pretty solid. You know, not mind blowing, charming. Mm-hmm. The main character is, you know, he certainly got his charms. But the things I liked about the game, let's just say that the things in the book, the storytelling, the kind of sensibility, the tone, it transfers into the game. Mm-hmm. But what the game offers is taking that storytelling, often dark, you know, really interested in kind of dark fairy tales, but mixed with, I guess, a more modern detective sort of sensibility, is that it takes that storytelling and it melds it to an experience of world that is not in the books. Now, we read fantasy novels often because we want to go there, right? We want to be in the world. But being in a world in a novel is, to me, very, very different than being in a world in a game. Mm-hmm. When you are in a world in Minecraft, you know, if we agree that that is something you can't be done elsewhere, The Witcher in different ways brings in that feeling so that you are, these stories are happening and you are not just at the center of them as the main character. I mean, one thing I like about Witcher is that you are not simply Geralt. You are not, it's not role playing. He's got a character. You can't just make him any way you want. You can alter him slightly, but he's always going to have his voice and his gruff demeanor and his basic decency. And so you are bringing you are still centered in that in a way. You are experiencing it through him, but you're also experiencing the world. And I feel like that. So when The Witcher is at its best, it is bringing the small, you know, the side quests that are famous, the small stories of people's lives that don't make the subjects of most games. Mm-hmm. I find the main quest of Witcher not its strength. It's fine. But you get this sense of the world, the lives of you know, regular people, and the world around them, the storms, the trees, the landscape in that game is pretty phenomenal. And the experience of it becomes something that is, to me, totally unlike reading The Last Wish. You know, when I played last year, I read that book and I also played the 2 DLC, which I didn't like as much as the main game, partially because they lost that sense of world. So the first one really focuses on this story that kind of loses the rest of the world. It takes place in a small piece of real estate. And it's so focused on its storytelling, which is, you know, it has a really great wedding scene and stuff, but it loses that world and it becomes just more like a decent story game. Mm-hmm. The Blood and Wine takes you to a fantastical place that is, you know, kind of a new place, a new world to be in, but one that is, because it's so much brighter and all this kind of stuff, it loses its, well, there's not much criticism and not enough criticism of that new fantasy land you're in. Mm-hmm. But it also, you know, the world that it's about, those two stories are about immortals, you know, the one like a vampire and like a gaunt or dim guy and immortals, basically, like, you know, almost, you know, kind of long lived people like Geralt and Ciri, and not about everyday people and their struggles. So right. I know everybody likes Witcher for different reasons. For me, you know, the ability to play in a world that does those world things that are unique, I think, to games, and yet tell, you know, moving, detailed, often dark and unpredictable stories about people's you know, people's lives, people with faces. The faces in The Witcher are really important. The regular people faces. I love the faces, and I love the way that this, you know, brings you in. You know, you could say that film does that, sure, but that, again, that sense of being there, of being embodied in a character in a space. I think this is something broadly that games, being in a world, being in a space, and being in an avatar that you have a complicated relationship to, are all, you know, pretty game specific things, and are all in The Witcher. That, you know, the fact that The Witcher can combine good storytelling, which games generally almost never do, is shocking to me, because I basically had gotten used to the Skyrims of the world, and the even games that can be, you know, cleverly written, like, a, you know, GTA is not, you know, the worst at this, but it can never really come. Its storytelling often seems at odds with the pleasure of its world. With The Witcher, they combined in a way that I hadn't seen before. And so it, you know, The Witcher 3 experience is not something you can have in a book or a film.
Right.
I don't know if that, I use the word world broadly here, but it's something I think about a lot. And I think that this sense of a world in a game is a, again, not just world building, storytelling, Lord of the Rings, you know, like,
but sure. a visceral yeah. sense of the world.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I guess I mean a moment to moment. I'm really thinking about the moment to moment experience of being there, and the way that kind of what it activates in you that as a reader, you know, is not activated.
Right. Yeah. So, I totally agree that, you know, video games, and I think this is something that we're kind of like heading towards with virtual reality and that kind of things, or like these virtual world kind of things. Right. And that's something sort of inherent to the promise of video games at the start of them, was you can go into these worlds and, you know, be some different person or just like live in a different world in kind of a visceral way. And yeah, I agree with that. I think that's true. I guess my position is that I'm skeptical that is as important as like we have always believed it was going to be. Like I'm skeptical that it actually matters. Like I think a lot about like how the state of someone's mind when they're engrossed in a book or into a movie, and it seems pretty similar. Like it, you know, you forget about yourself. You are immersed in any good work, it seems to me. And so I agree that it's different with video games, but I you know, I also think there are costs to that interactivity, which you nodded, you sort of alluded to a little bit with the Geralt's personality, and this is the whole ludonarrative dissonance thing where, you know, well, the player wants to do XYZ, but the character would never do that, you know? And that's, to me, that's like kind of the tip of an iceberg of like all of these things that we don't even think about, like just things that, you know, downtime, like all this like sort of tasks that we have to give players to do that like don't necessarily add to the worldliness. They're just a task.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Witcher has many of those. It's not blameless in that regard at all.
Right. Yeah. So interactively speaking, like, so I guess if, you know, talking about like stories, I think that we have a pretty good grasp on like, or not a pretty good grasp, but like we have some kind of grasp as a species on how to tell a story that like kind of works and communicates something and, you know, maybe is hopefully important, pushes the conversation forward, whatever. Does the things that, you know, we value in stories. Like we know how to make stories, and we kind of understand mechanics of stories to some extent, how that works. And so my thing is like, there are all that stuff that we know about, like, I don't know, plot structure, acts, and, you know, controlling ideas and characters and antagonists, all that kind of stuff. Like that kind of stuff exists also for interactive merit, like for interactivity itself has its own like discipline of implementation and that kind of stuff. You know, do you follow kind of what I'm trying to say?
What do you mean? What kind of interactive, I'm very familiar with the long history of like, you know, of narrative and the theory of narrative and all that sort of stuff. But what do you specifically mean with interactive?
I'm trying to say that like interactive entertainment or interactive art like has by has a way that it can provide interactive merit by the pure interactivity itself. And Minecraft, I think, is a wonderful example of that. That's very, you know, universally accepted, that everyone sort of understands that, you know, that's the thing. Minecraft, you know, it doesn't come from the graphics, it doesn't come from the story, it doesn't come from the music or anything else. It comes from the interactivity itself.
I suspect that people like Minecraft for pretty different reasons, because I know that, like, I consider it one of the best games of the last, you know, 10 years. Mm-hmm. But the reasons I like it, I don't often see people saying the same things. You know, I don't play creative mode. I admire, but don't ever go into those making elaborate structures and stuff. But for me, Minecraft was one of the first worlds, three-dimensional worlds, that was a real world. And I mean real, meaning that it's all really there. It's not, you know, it's not, you know, backdrops in a movie set and you can't go beyond. It's all really there.
Right.
And that is, you know, that sense of materiality and something, you know, it's all convertible because that's the way the mining and crafting works. But the fact of it being there and giving you a sense of being there is totally, you know, rare and extremely powerful. And I'm not sure that everybody loves it for the same reasons.
Well, I would say not everyone will say that that's something that they love, but I do think that that quality you just described is something that people consciously or subconsciously pick up on, and that it does affect them. Like, it's an objective fact about that system, that what you just described, you know? And and in the same way, the kinds of interactions that could exist, you know, that like when a player enters into Minecraft and they start messing with stuff and they start like figuring out like, oh, OK, I can do this, I can do this. They start getting this picture of this system that is not like immediately solvable. It's not, you know, they start having this like, oh, man, I could do X, Y, Z. I wonder if I can do, you know, J. and that sort of sense of wonder is coming from, and I think this is, again, something just, you know, objectively that exists with the Minecraft world. And it might not be the thing that excites you most about it or any particular individual about it, but it is something that's there in Minecraft. And so to bring it back to something like The Witcher or, you know, most games in that, I guess, like story game genre, you know, I'm always looking for like what like along that axis, you know, the interactive axis, do these have like any of that kind of merit? Because I feel like if they, you know, and I guess part of it is just, you know, maybe we just disagree about how much that, I say visceral, I know you maybe don't like the word visceral, but that feeling of immersion into a world, how much is that actually unique to video games, and how much is that even worth, even if it is unique to video games?
Those are both, am I guessing that you find that just something being unique to video games is itself a really important value to you?
Well, I think I'm a game designer. I'm somebody who's trying to make games, and I'm also a game design theory person who's trying to understand interactive systems and how we can make better ones. And so, you know, the things that are important to me are, I think we're looking at this form and we want to know what is it about this form? Like, what can we harness that's sort of intrinsic to this form? You know, what are things that are maybe baggage coming from other forms? You know, like, what are sort of like expectations, you know, vestigial sort of ideas that we have that are just like lingering around that are maybe causing us problems? And I generally feel like, you know, heavy story, like, you know, RPG style story in games tends to be a limiting factor for interactive merit. For, you know, the kinds of like, oh, wow, I wonder if I can do J type of things, which is just, you know, that's just one type of interactive merit. I'm not saying, I mean, there may be a whole, you know, rainbow of types of interactivity that we just haven't really touched on. And it's, to me, it's because, and this is why I'm not really into, I mean, one of many reasons I am not really into games like that is that, the interactivity itself is not, it just doesn't do very much for me. And, so, I mean,
I think, I mean, doesn't a lot of it come down to what it does for you or doesn't? So like when you're talking as a designer and these values for you, I can get that. I'm not a designer. And as a player, those things aren't very important to me. So, you know, I'm kind of with you in the sense that for a long time, I didn't seek story in games. If I told you my favorite games growing up, outside of a few exceptions, like a Final Fantasy VII or something like that, there were most of my favorite games, like, you know, I don't play Mario for the story, and I don't, and I think that, you know, paying too much attention to that seemed like, you know, just kind of missing the point. Mm-hmm. And that many of my favorite games, you know, narratively, you know, it just did very little. I think, though, I have, you know, in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, begun to see games that didn't just bring a, you know, a level of quality to the writing, but began to think about how story, you know, again, might do as is important to you, like only in a game type interactions that, mm-hmm. you know, do something different with that story. But it's something that's, for me, fairly, it's not that games didn't have stories before, and not that, you know, role-playing games, I think that, you know, early role-playing games, the narrative elements were important. They didn't always succeed for me in a way that they are, you know, I'm beginning to encounter examples now that are succeeding, whether they are, you know, Witcher is a good example, but so are games like 80 Days or Kentucky Route Zero or The Last Guardian, which is the narrative. You cannot take the narrative out of that game. It is key. And even if that game is less about world and to me more about a relationship, there is something, again, only in a video game can you create a, you know, virtual being, an AI, that, you know, that is, that you can interact with in this particular way. And it's absolutely in a narrative context. So maybe the different ways that narrative can be used or not, or it may just come down to, you know, if it doesn't do much for you, you know, because I think that a lot of it does. I mean, as a player, since I'm primarily just a player, I'm a critic, but a critic who is fundamentally a player. Mm-hmm. I want to play good games, right? Mm-hmm. I'm looking for good games. Those are very different, you know, year to year. I'm looking for new things. I don't like to repeat. I don't like sequels. I, you know, I have my own values there, but I'm not necessarily looking for, like, obviously, you know, if theory helps you, that's good, but it doesn't do much for me or have much to do with my playing of games or my criticism of games.
Gotcha.
I think that's more valuable to you, right? Because you feel like theory will lead us to better game design.
Yeah, I think so. Right? Yeah.
That's not really in my purview. The whether that's true or not, I'm skeptical that, like, the greatest games I've ever played are great because of the theory that informed their design. Explicit theory, not implicit, or, you know, mm-hmm. But something that was formulated and then implemented. I'm not sure that my favorite games of all time were made that way, but I'm also not someone who gets in behind the scenes and wants to learn all about the development process, so I really can't say. But,
well, I can tell you that your guess is probably correct, but that's not because theory isn't useful, but because we just haven't had a lot of time to develop theory yet. I think, like, it's very new in the, you know, it's early in the history of video games. We had 50 years ago, there was not a human being on planet Earth called a game designer, you know what I mean? So if you don't mind, I'd like to move on to the next sort of thing, sure. Which is, another thing that's really difficult for me, and maybe you can talk about this a little bit, is so you talked about escapism in your 1099 episode, and mm-hmm. The thing that kept coming to me was, and I think you made great points about escapism, how, like, we, you know, escapism is like it's an okay thing to exist, and but that we shouldn't have this automatic knee jerk, like, of course escapism is completely fine, and that it's fine that so many games are clearly just designed around escapism. I completely agree with that. Mm-hmm. I would also go further to say that, like, not all escapism is equally problematic. That takes us into stuff like something that's important to me that is one of my pet things that I talk about and not a lot of other people talk about is violence glorification in games. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that was difficult for me to, like, I tried to play The Witcher 3 and the tone with the way it talks about violence and the way it expresses violence, and not just violence, but other adjacent things like masculinity and those kind of things. It's just, it just feels so like toxic and gross. And I just, and like, I feel like I've been far enough away from video games for long enough that now I look at video games the way that non-gamers see it. You know, like those people who never played video games their whole life, and they come in to the living room and someone's playing The Witcher and they're just like, ew, what the hell is this? That's kind of my feeling. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's really good to keep to, especially if you've played games all your life, to really keep those perspectives in mind. My wife is not a lifelong gamer and doesn't have much experience, and so I often get a really different perspective from her that I find really helpful. I'm also always just looking for games we can play together. So, you know, a game that we can, you know, will goes really far with me. But I definitely, I feel so. Escapism, as you know, that there's good and bad escapisms, or lesser or better. Yeah, I'm a little, I guess I don't want to lose sight of escapism itself and find good ones. I said something, you know, to this effect in the 1099 podcast, that I don't want it to be a battle of my escapism versus your escapism, because that is not only really boring, but also, you know, I'm always going back to a kind of self-examination, or a kind of, you know, thinking about, and I don't want to create a conflict that just kind of short circuits all that, and so that we lose sight of that. I think that escapism itself, and not just in games, whether it's binge watching or it is, you know, getting, you know, lost in novels, which I have many times in my life, and I think there is great pleasure and real value in that. But escapism as a retreat from the world, as a kind of, you know, looking for a refuge, which again is sometimes necessary, but man, it goes overboard so quickly. And games, with their kind of design, especially in their just addictiveness, like they really they take that you know, really far, really quickly. However, you know, if you want to talk about like some of the effects of escapism, and the kind of more toxic or just plain, you know, nasty things.
The political values that are being put, that are being, you know, that we're like a, sort of agreeing to implicitly somehow by escaping to certain worlds. You know what I mean?
Well, you're definitely, you're embodying them. They're going through you in a way by that interaction that is not quite the same in other media. But I don't think it necessarily makes you, it could feel culpable. I think that sometimes when you, I just think some people don't want to really look at their pleasures directly. You know, it's, again, it's that what we love and criticizing it, but also like leaving what you love still fundamentally alone, or just, again, compartmentalizing so that you can preserve your love instead of even looking at that. And love is a nice word. Let's just put it as like or pleasure. So that, for instance, when someone's playing a shooter, so there was a bunch of shooters last year, and they, you know, a lot of people wanted to say this was like a great year for shooters. Shooters are back, you know? And I've never been a big fan of first person shooters. I loved the first Halo when it came out because it was doing things I had never quite seen before. And I like playing with my brother. So, you know, I'm not immune to those, but, there is something when you read still when people talk about shooters. And again, this is, it's not exclusive, but it is, we're talking a lot about young men, and we're talking about young male critics who are academic and very smart, and yet still have this love of shooting that they're just dying to like, they're a little like annoyed that people don't give it enough respect, and they want to get it out there and be like, damn it, this is important too. And I'm like, all right. But I mean, come on, man. Like, getting that excited about the new Doom, you know, trying to make it more than what it is, like, that's like somehow meaningful violence now because the Doom Marine like has, you know, hand gestures that are indicative of character. I'm just like, please, like, get a little perspective here. Like, this is a game that, you know, you want to make it like its core loop of glory kills and getting ammo and health back is like it's some sort of like deep, you know, evocative like experience. Please, I get its pleasures, but come on. And I, you know, there was a review I read of Infinite Warfare this year that basically it was a, you know, fairly mixed or negative review, but it was like Call of Duty Infinite Warfare is an unambivalent glorification of like war. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, that really like sticks in your craw, doesn't it? Because you want that ambivalence. You want shooters. Yeah. You love shooters, actually, and you admit it. And you love ambivalence because ambivalence is a great place to hide.
Right.
You can hide in your, we're all full of mixed feelings, but there is a fetishization of ambivalence and the seeming complexity as a place to like, you know, say, oh, well, the earlier Call of Duties were, you know, really actually like really complex comments on war and all that. Okay, but what about what you liked about it? What about the pleasure you took in it?
Yeah.
Because that, you're not going there. And I don't respect that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of stuff comes up all the time where no one wants to really face what they're enjoying, what that might reveal about themselves. And, you know, what's maybe kind of, you know, fucked up about some of the pleasures they take. Mm-hmm. I'm willing, you know, sometimes they're just not... They're, wherever you're coming from, the masculinity involved, the pleasure and dominance and all of that, and it is just there, and you better, you know, it's much better to face it. So I hear you on that. I also hear it in The Witcher. You know, The Witcher has one of the worst scenes that I saw that year when it comes to portrayal of women. Now, I think the game has some actually extremely complex women and it does right by its main characters. However, there's a scene with a character named Horsun Jr. and he's like a serial murderer of women. And you basically, you know, find him. And there's women like, you know, pinned to the wall dead in a one woman is hanging from the rafters. There is this, it's horrifying, you know, display. Mm-hmm. And the game treats him with this almost like you can choose to kill him or not. Mm-hmm. While you're in the cutscene, because, you know, one of the impressive things that Witcher does is that it keeps the cutscenes in the world, in the engine. So you have like a woman's like leg swinging behind you in the cutscene, right, because it's happening in game.
Sure.
And it's just this grotesque display that gives you, you know, The Witcher is famous kind of sometimes for its tenderness, but it misplaces that sometimes, or it falls into tropes that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't quite know how to handle. And if you kill this guy who deserves to be killed.
Well, and by the way, that's just taken for granted. Like, of course, the death penalty is absolutely like, that's another political thing that's just like slipped under there that like we just don't even think about.
Well, you know, my own, for me, there's a difference in a state killing someone and you. I mean, I don't have a problem thinking this guy deserves to die. That doesn't bother
me. Well, even if you don't, you should recognize that it is a politically charged message that, you know, like, it's basically like, you know, what else are you going to do, you know?
Well,
like,
that Geralt's the judge, jury, and executioner.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
That I see. I'm just saying that the problem in this scene is not, oh,
no, I get you.
I get to kill this guy. It's that when you do, if you do choose to kill him, mm-hmm. and I did, it cuts to black, so you don't see no blood. You know, there's blood. There's like women everywhere in poses everywhere. There's blood everywhere. But for him, there's no blood, and it cuts to black, and then you just see his like lifeless body after that.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's ridiculous. It's in the middle of my favorite game of that year. It's the most egregious scene like that. But there's plenty of other problems. And coming from, you know, it's not just the violence, and it's not just specifically the violence on women. It is a kind of masculinity that I think that Geralt's a pretty complicated character, but it's not like he doesn't fit into, you know, a certain ideal of masculine sobriety and sort of, you know,
Rambo.
I do think he challenges that more than a lot of those gruff, you know, dudes.
Sure.
But yeah, it's totally there. And so I think that acknowledging that, is necessary. It's not, you know, you have to, again, it doesn't, I think for some people that would ruin the game, and I'm totally like good with that. Like I think that if it ruins the game for you,
well,
then it should. I mean that's what I value that a great deal too. It didn't, you know, in a 100-hour game, it didn't. But I'm not going to argue with someone who it does.
Yeah.
Because I think that's
the reason, you know, it does is not because of those, like that moment that you described with the torture chamber or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not because of those. Those to me are the tip of the iceberg of this, you know, that same aesthetic that's in that scene so pointedly. I sort of see it all over the thing, like just in like the way that characters talk, like it's just like dripping from the whole thing. And I feel like we kind of don't see it because we're just so embroiled in it. Like we were raised with it. And, you know, action movies is the same thing. Comic books is the same thing. I think a lot of those worlds, like there's just a language and we're just so used to it. And we just accept like so much like horrible violence, glorification, sexism, all kinds of just terrible ideas, because it's just like, oh, it's like part of the, yeah, it's like, you know, it's an action game, it's an action movie, like that's what it is, it just has all this stuff. And
yes, and those, you know, they're not the what you're doing in The Witcher half the time, the fighting and things like that are, you know, not only all of what you're saying, they're also the least interesting parts of the game. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, having played all of The Witcher, it does a lot of things, it takes some of those things in complicated directions, and it does things that you wouldn't expect, and challenges itself in ways that, when what you're describing, you wouldn't expect, having played, you know, if you play all the way through it. However, I don't want to lose sight of the bigger, you know, the larger kind of like picture of the values that it is, you know, propagating and continuing, that I think you're right about. A specific game might be able to complicate that, but it's still participating in a way that is ultimately pretty, you know, deflating, just sort of like, you know, yeah, it's so shot through, it's so everywhere, that it can be hard to, it becomes the air you breathe and you don't notice it anymore.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to always keep noticing it.
Yeah.
To keep calling it bullshit, to keep questioning, why that's okay or seems okay for most of us. And what alternatives are there? The thing is there are alternatives. I mean, I think like a game like this year's, you know, The Last Guardian, mm-hmm. which is my favorite, as I've said, it is a different kind of game, a different kind of relationship, that is, it was really shocking to me to watch the receptions of that game in Final Fantasy XV, because some of these things that you're talking about that are kind of almost easy to point out, the violence, the betrayal of women, the just, you know, the subjectivities of women being sidelined for men. I mean, mm-hmm. the things that are kind of obviously a huge problem. There are smaller things in the tropes and kind of gamisms that we get used to, such that when, you know, when they're thwarted, when The Last Guardian doesn't play, you know, like you expect a modern game to, mm-hmm. when it, you know, doesn't, when its camera resists you, when it's, you know, when the expressionism of the controls makes the jump missed or something like that, you see people's, you know, other game values that they take for granted quickly come to the surface. And mm-hmm. I thought that the receptions of those two, of Last Guardian and Final Fantasy XV, were really, really telling and really, really damning about that background radiation of gaming.
Right.
You just see in the Final Fantasy XV, that was where you saw people acknowledging its faults and yet saying, you know, but I still like it, it's still good. Basically, you know, both of the games got mixed reactions, except Final Fantasy XV's is kind of seen as a triumph. It's basically positive. And Last Guardians, even though some people admit, well, maybe this is a revolutionary game, maybe this is amazing. But the things it doesn't, the things that people think it messes up with, they are less forgiving of, because they're kind of, you know, game things. And yeah. I think it's so damning. I feel like often like the gamer in us, the person who has played and gotten used to all of this, we're kind of been ruined by years of playing games. There's something that's been ruined in us by playing too many games, because you develop these expectations that make you, you know, miss what's going on in The Last Guardian because you're concerned about platforming.
Mm-hmm.
And I love platformers. So yeah. it's not like I don't get it. And then you're willing to overlook Final Fantasy's just embarrassing. It's such an embarrassing game.
I watched some cutscenes from that and I was, it's like a...
Oh my.
It's like The Room or something.
The cutscenes are like the worst. I mean, it's the worst storytelling you've ever seen.
Talk
about storytelling in games. All of the old stuff that we just used to say like, oh, well, this is games and, you know, whatever. And people just totally accept it and are just, you know, give me my boys.
Right.
Give me Final Fantasy again, redeemed. I'm so desperate for a good Final Fantasy. And hey, me too. I would like a good Final Fantasy too. But man, I found the receptions of those so telling, and so they ended up being my best and worst, and yet to see how they're talked about, and this gets into, you know, maybe it's the criticism that goes into that, the kind of social atmosphere around games that I find also ruinous. But yeah, there's so much. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I really like that the comparison that you draw between Final Fantasy 15 and The Last Guardian. I think that's a really good like case study of this problem of just the lack of sort of broader perspective of gamers. I mean, one of the reasons I think we've had such a toxic little ball of like bad mojo in the games community is because we've been so isolated, because we've like had this sort of self-protective thing that we've been talking about like, you know, oh no, we must love it, and it's very identity based, and you know, that all that kind of stuff. Now I'm just like, as an adult, as a person who's becoming more politically active, as a person who's becoming more socially aware, it's like I can't ignore this stuff at all anymore. Like, you know, for example, like, I don't know your politics or your position on something like guns, for example, but I mean, you know, I think Americans have at very least we can say a unique perspective on guns and, you know, globally speaking. And I just think it's a little bit strange that like every big movie has to have a gun on the cover. And like a lot of our big games just have like, you know, you're holding a gun. And I just, this idea of like worship of guns and, you know, like, I just think everything is political. I'm learning more and more that like everything is political and gamers are just so disconnected from that. And this example of the, you know, The Last Guardian to me, I haven't played it, but I've looked up stuff from it and it looks like, it looks perfectly like, yeah, that looks nice. You know, I could see myself, I probably have interactive level issues with it, but, you know, as a thematically, I'm not like grossed out. I'm like, nothing about it like screams, get the hell away from this. This is like, you know, and so that's, yeah, and that's valuable. I feel like, you know, that's something that, you know, people, we just need to think more about that. And so I figured that you would be somebody who is sympathetic to that. And
I think that, I don't like The Last Guardian because it's a nice story. I mean, that's great. I do agree. I think that some of the worst aspects of games that need to be criticized come in how we relate to them. And I think that the subject matter just reinforces a lot of those things. So that like, you know, with gun control, I mean, I'm very strong for gun control, as you asked, but
yeah, I think am
when
too.
It comes, yeah. I also just find, I'm not, you know, I'm from the South, but not really a part of gun culture in my family or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that there's not, you know, relation, like connections that have been built over time, but in, you know, that are meaningful to people. But you know, when it comes to shooting in games, I find like mechanically in a first person shooter, shooting is practically the same thing as looking, right?
Yeah. Yep.
It is looking, which is a thing I like about, you know, like, in games, I like looking.
Sure.
And there is some weird sort of way in which shooting in games is a perversion of looking in the first person that really is so uninteresting. Like,
it's all about
much more interesting.
You look at things and you make them go away. You make them disappear as quickly as possible.
Right. It is. I mean, a gun is like a coward's weapon, you know, like to kill someone from a distance. Like, come on.
But a sword is really no different fundamentally. I mean, it's still you look and then you make them disappear, you know?
Yes, in the mechanics of a game, yes, I guess more in general, that like the intimacy of a combat that brings you in close and doesn't, you know, get to like lay back, this kind of idea of I'm going to lay back and survey my surroundings, sure, and, you know, find you, you know, snipe you. That is just like a fundamental position that I think games encourage, this sort of like a pulling back. I have a God's eye view. I'm removed. It's the fantasy of stealth. I'm there, but I'm not there. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if you're going to have violence in a game, I want it to be much more intimate and much more in your face, and not this distant sort of, you know, I saw you first, boom, you're down, you're gone. Yeah.
Right.
But I also just, you know, some of the basic mechanics of shooting in games is, you know, beyond all that other stuff is so very boring. But when you the values of dominating, of seeing and disappearing someone versus, you know, The Last Guardian, it's not just that it's not gross. I mean, it's not, but that the game is, you know, this is what people also, they get that this is the point, but they don't like this point, which is that, you know, you've heard Trico resists you. Right. Mm-hmm. Your companion doesn't obey, you know, immediately. There's not just a delay between asking him to do something and it happening, but he just won't sometimes. Uh-huh. And that resistance to the gamer, you know, is something that I think is so valuable. And it shot through. The controls resist you a little bit. The camera, that game resists you. Mm-hmm. And this problem of control in games that give people a sense of it's a fantasy, not just a power fantasy and fairness fantasy and all that. There's a, you know, this control, this perfect control fantasy. I want to ask a question, like, why should we have perfect camera controls?
Sure.
You're used to that, right?
Yeah.
Why have perfect camera controls? Why have perfect controls, you know, perfect, quote unquote, period? Because, you know, the assumptions that go with that, and they're just, you know, I don't know, getting what you want. And this is one of the problem in game. Getting exactly what you want is like ruinous.
Right.
And for you personally.
And I could say mechanically speaking, it's the same deal. Like having direct interactions is typically is a problem for game design, actually. Like, you know, in a lot of the best, most well-designed, games, just mechanically speaking, have, I don't know if you've ever played any like Euro games or anything like board games, but some of those have very indirect interactions between players. And so that things are do feel sort of imperfect. And that is, you know, mechanically speaking, like thematically and politically, I think that's good, because when you're describing resistance, you're describing a relationship, which is like markedly. Right. To me, the through line of video game culture is misanthropy, you know, just like hatred of human beings or hatred of other things and just like dominance over them. And, you know, and so something like having like something resisting you, that is like, that's like the core of a relationship, you know? And so that's probably why gamers hate it so much. They're just so not used to that.
Right. And that as a value, you know, to really look closely at that, the way that resistance works, why the resistance is being resisted and what people are going to games for. I think we have to kind of constantly come back to that question, because that relationship in the game, but also how you as a player are relating to the game, right? That's that fundamental relationship that, again, in our love, in our hobby, in whatever ways we want to kind of, you know, protect it or diminish it, we don't want to take it seriously. And I think you're right that there is something that seeks to transcend the human, to, you know, get something purer or something that is going to get rid of the mess, get rid of the resistance. That kind of fantasy is something I can never get behind.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Well, go on.
Well, I was just going to say that I think one of the things that really kind of props up some of these fantasies. So on the one hand, we're all talking like on a personal level. Yes, we play the games and we have all these relationships to them. And I'm criticizing a lot of that. But I also think that the social atmosphere in gaming really contributes to this in a way. Some ways are obvious, right? We know about toxic online culture, right? We know about the ways in which, you know, online culture itself just kind of gets so gross so quickly, and that there are just these, you know, these forces that we don't know how to deal with, and online, you know, stuff has exacerbated them even further. But I also think that, you know, one of my frustrations as a critic is the way in which that so many critics are so focused socially. So what I mean by that is there is this this kind of clubism, mm-hmm. this kind of this, but it's not even just that they're all friends or, you know, that's necessarily a problem. It's that you have this constant focus on what other people are saying, what your friends are saying, what is being said, you know, what is acceptable to say.
Yeah.
And so you're always fighting these straw men, you know, choosing easy targets, you know, people who want to just like fight gamers all the time. What an easy target that is.
Right.
And they don't want to fight the gamer in themselves, because that gamer is definitely there, and it'll come out at times. But they don't want to do that. And instead they're constantly, you know, engaging an audience that is distracting them from themselves, from their own experience. And I just think that it gets, I didn't like Firewatch this year. There's a narrative game to me that fails. But one of the most frustrating things I read about it was a critic named Brendan Keough. And I often have a lot of...
I know him. Yeah.
You know him. Yeah. Okay. But what he said something about, he was doing his best games of the year, and let me pull it up real quick, cause I want to get it right. He was talking about Firewatch,
uh-huh.
and he said, so he's saying that, you know, it's one of his favorite games of the year, but he's not praising it to the moon. I mean, he's got pretty tempered and he's got some problems with it. But what he says is, what was most exciting about Firewatch for me was actually the fact that I heard people criticize its story and writing, not publicly. Publicly, the general rule of thumb as a critic is still justifiably that you are meant to applaud these games as a normalization against and a fuck you to the hegemony of game culture that would rather not see them exist at all. So when I read that, I was like, oh God, this is exactly what I've hated for so long, that you acknowledge that Firewatch, you know, I mean, Firewatch is praised all over the place. You know, it wins all sorts of things. Great for it. To act like, you know, in that there was real criticism, but it wasn't public. And he was not only okay with it, but it's justifiable to him that, you know, Firewatch is being, you know, threatened by game culture, even though it is succeeding wildly.
Mm-hmm.
but it is being threatened by gamers, and that, you know, we have to keep these criticisms private instead of public. I find that distinction so ridiculous, and frankly, it reminds me of like why critics aren't taken seriously outside their own circle. Like, they're often accused of, like, you know, propping up the games that they like and just talking amongst themselves. And if you think it's like, oh, finally we're getting outside of, like, you know, we're moving our private criticisms public, you should have been doing that 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
sure.
Like this idea that you know, you had these criticisms and they're correct criticisms about the, you know, the plotting and all these kind of things, that you're keeping them, you know, to yourself. How can I take you seriously as a critic?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing but being, you know, a socially minded critic who's just kind of, you know, feeding into that entire, like, you know, game of clubby sort of like in and out and that consensus that we need to preserve the consensus that, you know, Firewatch is, you know, Firewatch has plenty of good qualities to it, but come on, like, so I find that you, and you take some of these individual things, and then you, and on top of all that, you have all this social, it's why, you know, at the beginning you're saying, you know, feeling like you're alone often in things. And I think we often feel this,
mm-hmm.
Because the social atmosphere is dishonest. It is not telling the truth above
right,
all.
Right.
It is concerned with so many other things, and if you can't tell the truth, if you can't speak to the truth of your experience as a critic, as a player, whatever,
mm-hmm.
then I don't know what the point of any of it is. You know, like, I find that so, I don't know, and I just disappointing, but like,
counterproductive. And
counterproductive, pitiful, like, mm-hmm. come on, like, what are you here for? There's so much that, you know, to be said, and there's so much, like, you seem to be distracting yourself with all this social thinking. And again, you're never gonna, you're not bringing it back home. You're not bringing it back to, like, you know, you in the game and what's going on and all that that reveals.
Right.
Because I think that games reveal so much about us. It is part of their power. You know, it is part of what I would say, you know, stories in novels and films also can probe us in ways, but games almost make it unavoidable.
Right.
They involve you and make you complicit. And I find that the, you know, if narrative has a place in games too, part of it is to take some of those things that they were, yeah, we're already doing pretty well in other media and really twist the knife.
You know? Yeah.
Really, really like bring it home and get you to, like, you know, be honest. And
yeah, I want to hear what these human beings actually have to say about these games.
Exactly.
Not these gamers. You know, there's like this gamer identity thing that people have, and I hope that what you're saying is as true as you think it is, that that people are pretty conscious of a lot of these problems, but they actually consciously choose not to talk about them, because my fear is that it's the air we breathe, and that, like, we actually kind of don't even see it a lot of, and I think it's some mix of those two. I don't know what percentage, but
I think that's right. I don't think we're always conscious of it, but then when we become conscious, we quickly push it aside.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that Brendan was willing to, like, say it right there, I was kind of like, okay, you know, I thought that.
Sure, sure.
I thought that was going on. You said it, good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it is a mix of, you know, life keeps going on every day. We're at moments conscious, at many moments not. And trying to bring that not just that conscious, not be more conscious, but, you know, bring it to bear, and not just kind of, oh, this was my private shower thought, and not,
yeah, right, sure,
something out there.
Great, yeah, I think we'll probably wrap it up around there. But
okay, sure.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and this has been really great, and I'd love to talk to you again sometime.
Sure, I would enjoy that. Is this kind of what you were expecting, or what?
Yeah, no, this is exactly. I hit all my points pretty much, and okay. I mean, there's a lot I can push back on more. There's some, like, big. I sense that we have a couple of, like, big disagreements about art and taste and things like
sure.
that, and
sure.
and mechanical. Oh, I did have one quick little silly question to ask you, which was okay. If whether you play strategy or competitive games or board games specifically at all. If you have any experience with those.
Yes, I do. I don't play a lot of board games. It's something I've become a little more interested in the past few years.
I recommend it.
Because I have, yeah, many people are recommending it.
Well, especially given this conversation, because, like, I think board games are sort of more inherently social and less inherently antisocial. But go on.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I grew up playing, you know, I mean, nothing very complex. We're talking about, like, Risk and things,
sure.
things like that. That yes, I enjoyed. I am a pretty, like, I have good friends, but we haven't always lived near each other. And the opportunities for that have been, they do live near me now. So it's like, there's no real reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to strategy games, not I don't have a deep history. I try to play everything. I try not to limit any genres. Probably my you know, longest experience with a strategy game is Civ.
Mm-hmm.
So I played probably Civ 2, 3, and 4 the most.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the 4 even the most.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
And for, you know, as is with those games, you know, for many, many, many hours.
Sure.
I loved Civ 4. And I think, and I've tried since then. So I played Civ 5 some. I tried Endless Legend a couple years ago, which was, I don't know if you ever played that.
It
was
no, kind of I haven't played that one.
Civ-like, but it was doing more with narrative and faction differences and stuff. And I do, I get lost like everybody in Civ. I've always had a little bit of trouble with the shape of some of Civ or Civ-like games, in the sense that the feelings I feel at the beginning, middle, and end, and I know that, you know, Civ type games can have trouble with end games, and they've taken various steps to change that. You know, my excitement in the beginning, with this, you know, this is the explorer in me, the the person who's most interested in their scout, basically mapping out the land and feeling out, you know, space and what's what. I really feel space. I love Civ IV's culture. I love the cultural, like, ability to grow your culture and see your borders and see them, like, overtake someone. Sure. I wasn't really into the military aspects of the game, but so there's something I really love about that. They don't tend to be, so I guess when I try to play Civ 5 or other games, there's a familiarity there, a familiarity in the shape, a kind of excitement at the beginning, and then getting really bogged down in the middle, and then just petering out at the end.
Yeah,
big time. Right, so I don't want to repeat that all. I mean, I repeated it plenty with Civ 4. And after that, I was kind of like, okay, I'm waiting for, like, when I hear about a strategy game that does that differently, when it can really offer a different kind of experience, then I'm interested in trying that. That's why I tried Endless Legend. Otherwise, if I want that again, I'll just, okay, I guess I could play Civ 4.
Sure.
I play strategy games. Like, I mean, I play, like, I don't know if you're talking about, like, Fire Emblem, things like that.
Sure, yeah.
So I enjoyed that, though I had some narrative problems with the Fire Emblem Awakening. I've played some games like that, that kind of tactical, you know, from Final Fantasy Tactics through
Fire Emblem. Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I played those. I enjoy them. Even with Fire Emblem, like, I love thinking spatially. So I love feeling out, like, the phenomenological field that, you know, comes out from, you know, my move, how far I can move, how far I can affect things. I love to feel that out. I love to look at maps. I love to look at, you know, 3D isometric spaces that are, you know, at different heights. I love all that.
Yeah, strategy games also have that quality that you talked about in Minecraft, where it's like, it's a real thing. You know, it's like, this
It's all consequential.
Exactly.
Right. I really like that. I want mountains to be insurmountable. I want things to, like, I want there to be shape to the space, and for it to have real impact and effect.
Yeah.
So I you know, there's not, I'm not as interested in a kind of pure strategizing of elements. I definitely love spaces in games. And I love to feel them out. So yes, I have some inherent interest in some kinds of strategy games. I have to say, though, in the last probably 5 years, I haven't played one that really got me and that I felt was doing something.
I think that's because you're not playing. They're mostly in board games. The board game world is like, very, very, lots of strategy games that are very, like, you know, approachable, and but also very deep, and don't have like this just sit there hitting next turn for the next 100 turns kind of problem that, like, Civ has. There's not a lot in strategy games and video games. It's not really, which is why I myself have been moving more into developing for board games myself. But
are there any games you could recommend?
I have a lot of games. Like, one that's good for spatial stuff that's very simple would be Through the Desert. It's a little bit like the old ancient game of Go, if you've seen that.
I've played Go.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's a little bit like that, but, like, playable, because Go is, like, pretty ridiculous. You know, this is, like, super easy. Go is rough, but this is not rough. This is very clean and easy to play. And if you want something a little heavier, I would suggest try something like Puerto Rico, or I can give you a list after this thing.
Okay.
But there's a whole world of, like, these board games that are just,
it's a world I don't know, and it's a world that, like I said, I have a few friends who would be interested. But again, we've only started living around each other the past couple of years, and it's something we talk about. But we, you know, none of us quite know where to begin.
So BoardGameGeek.com is a really good resource. They have like just a list of top games, and you can just go through those and just check them out. But the reason I sort of bring it up too is because board games, both mechanically and thematically, tend to sort of reset my expectations a little bit when I go back and look at video games, because their themes tend to be a little bit more humanizing and a little bit less like I'm just gonna, you know, delete you from existence. Their mechanics tend to be a little bit more, you know, like the phrase I use is interactive merit. There's like a little bit more like your input is really required here, you know. That's one expression of my big problem with video games is, you know, just automate it. Like, if it's this obvious dumb thing, can you just have a thing just do it for me and just, like, tell me how it turned out, you know? So I like my input. If you're asking me for my input, I like my input to be, like, required. And so board games are good with that because, like, you know, it's actually, you know, I mean, we're hearing more about you. I mean, you said at the beginning of this, it's about the player. And so if I just have to walk to that green arrow, what does that say about me? You know, that says very little about me.
It says that you are compliant. You will do what you are asked to do.
Yes, that's true. I'm very, very compliant gear in the machine that is this this game. So, yeah, anyway, that was just a little spiel about board games.
Well, that's good. I like things, you know, I try to, you know, as many games as I play, I am involved in a lot of different media, and a lot of I search for things that will send me back into games in a different way. Because even I, you know, like I can be all critical, but I get acclimated to things. I get, you know, your expectations are always kind of adjusting with the times and stuff. And so anything that can make me not necessarily just more critical, but also like
wider perspective. Send me,
And see that things are, you know, being done in ways that games are just, you know, not especially when you talk about the human, because that is, you know, most of my best board game experiences are, you know, tales between my friends of betrayal and of, you know, something that just is, you know, kind of messy and our person is really like, you know, present.
It's about the relationship. Even if it's like spiky and mean, it's still about the relationship.
Okay, well that's good to know. I'll check some of those out.
Yeah, cool. I'll send you some links. Anyway, thank you again so much for coming on. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say before you go, but
I said a lot.
Cool.
I'm good.
I will, you know, put up links to all your stuff. I'm a big fan of yours, and keep doing what you're doing, and thank you again so much for coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.